Now, let all who have gathered in beloved community, whether in virtual space or in person, join our spirits in worship together. Whether you're joining us online or here in the sanctuary, welcome to First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. We are a spiritual community dedicated to a free and responsible search for truth, meaning, and beauty. I'm Reverend Chris Jimerson, co-lead minister here at the church. My pronouns are he, him. It is a joy to be with you this morning. Today we have a very special guest co-worship leader who will provide us with our sermon and other service elements over video. Reverend Christina Spod, she, her, currently serves as the contract minister for the UU Church of Tarpon Springs, Florida. Her six-word story of faith is, "We're here to build love's house." She's passionate about making the way for more justice in this world. If you are new to the church, I also want to welcome you this morning. If you're joining us remotely, and if you can, please say hello in the comments and let us know from where you're watching the service. If you're here in person, please join us for the social hour after worship. Either way, we invite you to fill out the online visitor form. Just go to austinuu.org, click on worship, and then the link to the form. We'd love to get to know you just a little bit better. Here, we welcome everyone. Every beginning and path, every beautiful expression of human flowering, all pronouns, love whomever we love, every ability or disability, each and every one of you. You are welcome here. Whether in person or through virtual space, you belong here. We come from a long tradition of seeing a spark of the divine in every person. And it's in that tradition that I invite you to greet the holy among us this morning, either in the comments online or by turning to those around you if you were here in person. Please join me now in our words for lighting the chalice. This is the flame we hold in our hearts as we strive for justice for everyone. This is the light we shine upon systems of oppression until they are no more. This is the warmth we share with one another as our struggle becomes our salvation. Our call to worship this morning is from Rilke's Book of Hours, Love Poems to God, translated by Anita Barrows and Joanna Macy. God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You, sent out beyond your recall, go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like a flame and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. You will know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand. Come. Let us worship together. One of the things that binds this church together as a religious community is that we have a common religious purpose. For First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin, that common purpose is our mission. The congregation wrote it together, we put it on our wall, and the folks participating in worship every Sunday say it together, so that we might more readily carry it in our hearts throughout the week. Let's say it together now. Together, we nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice to build the beloved community.
my lovely, I seek to beseech you, but I am all out of flowers to reach you. Standing still in my thoughts, I can't let this moment pass me by. Oh, my conscious, I know I should heed you, but I don't have a clue how to heed you. I'll say hello, you golden fellow, and may you take me in. Daylight, you take me so easy, and I'm filled by the breath that you leave me. If I'm feeling too far, can you let your warming hand in mine? Oh, my future, you've entered my slumber, and I look towards your sun in such wonder. I'll say hello, you golden mellow, and may you take me in. Da da da, ooh, ya da da da, ooh, ya da da da, ooh, ya da da da. Alive and well, in time we will realize the day we're born. The day we have won, when all is felt and hope is idealized, it's still in our hearts we're begging for. Fast asleep, awoken by reverence, making way for things left undone. We'll laugh and sing a song of remembrance, still in our hearts we're begging for. All could be changed, but the story never ends. All could be saved by the simplest note, a simple hello. And all that I know is that troubles never end. All could be saved when I take you in. You took
Good morning. I am the Reverend Christina Spouty, and I am so glad to be joining you today by Zoom. I would like to introduce myself by saying that I am a white woman appearing to be in my 30s. I have shoulder-length curly brown hair parted on one side and blue eyes, and today I am wearing a coral top. The story that I have for you today is called Roxaboxin, written by Alice McLaren and illustrated by Barbara Cooney. Marion called it Roxaboxin. She always knew the name of everything. There, across the road, it looked like a rocky hill. Nothing but sand and rocks, some old wooden boxes, cactus and greasewood, and thorny acatillo. but it was a special place. The street between Roxaboxen and the houses curved like a river, so Marion named it River Road. After that, you had to ford a river to reach Roxaboxen. Of course, all of Marion's sisters came, Anna May and Frances and little Jean. Charles from next door, even though he was 12. Oh, and Eleanor, naturally, and Jamie with his brother Paul. Later on, there were others, but these were the first. Well, not really the first. Roxaboxen had always been there and must have belonged to others long before. When Marion dug up a tin box filled with round black pebbles, everyone knew exactly what it was. It was buried treasure. Those pebbles were the money of Roxaboxen. You could still find others like them if you looked hard enough. So some days became treasure hunting days, with everybody trying to find that special kind. And then on other days, you might just find one without even looking. A town of Roxaboxen began to grow, traced in lines of stone, Main Street first edged with the whitest stones, and then the houses. Charles made his of the biggest stones. After all, he was the oldest. At first, the houses were very plain, but soon they began to add more rooms. The old wooden boxes could be shelves or tables or anything you wanted. You could find pieces of pottery for dishes. Round pieces were the best. Later on, there was a town hall. Marion was mayor, of course. That was just the way she was. Nobody minded. After a while, they added other streets. Frances moved to one of them and built herself a new house outlined in desert glass, bits of amber, amethyst, and sea green, a house of jewels. And because everybody had plenty of money, there were plenty of shops. Jean helped Anna May in the bakery, pies and cakes and bread baked warm in the sun. There were two ice cream parlors. Was Paul's ice cream the best or Eleanor's? Everybody kept trying them both. In Roxaboxen, you can eat all the ice cream you want. Everybody had a car. All you needed was something round for a steering wheel. Of course, if you broke the speed limit, you had to go to jail. The jail had cactus on the floor to make it uncomfortable, and Jamie was the policeman. Anna May. Quiet little Anna May was always speeding. You'd think she liked to go to jail. But if you had a horse, you could go as fast as the wind. There were no speed limits for horses, and you didn't have to stay on the roads. All you needed for a horse was a stick with some kind of bridle, and you could gallop anywhere. Sometimes there were wars. Once there was a great war, boys against girls. Charles and Marion were the generals. The girls had Fort Irene, and they were all Girl Scouts. The boys made a fort at the other end of Roxaboxen, and they were all bandits. Oh, the raids were fierce. Loud with whooping and the stamping of horses. The whirling swords of Acatillo had sharp thorns, but when you reached your fort, you were safe. Roxaboxen had a cemetery in case anyone died, but the only grave in it was for a lizard. Each year when the cactus bloomed, they decorated the grave with flowers. Sometimes in the winter, when everybody was at school and the weather was bad, no one went to Roxaboxen at all, not for weeks and weeks. But it didn't matter. Roxaboxen was always waiting. Roxaboxen was always there. And spring came, and the Acatillo bloomed, and everybody sucked the honey from its flowers, and everybody built new rooms, and everybody decided to have jeweled windows. That summer, there were three new houses on the East Slope and two new shops on Main Street. And so it went. The seasons changed and the years went by. Roxaboxen was always there. The years went by and the seasons changed until at last the friends had all grown tall, and one by one they moved away to other houses, to other towns. So you might think that that was the end of Roxaboxen, but oh no, because none of them ever forgot Roxaboxen. Not one of them ever forgot. Years later, Marion's children listened to stories of that place and fell asleep dreaming dreams of Roxaboxen. Gray-haired Charles picked up a black pebble on the beach and stood holding it, remembering Roxaboxen. More than 50 years later, Frances went back and Roxaboxen was still there. She could see the white stones bordering Main Street, and there where she had built her house, the desert glass still glowed, amethyst, amber, and sea green.
This is the time during the service when we commit to the mission and ministries of this church by making an offering. We give of our own so that together we might build a better world. You can give in several different ways by going to austinuu.org and clicking on the link at the top right side of the page. You can text your contribution to 84321.
Betrayed their lives at stake. Lovers drift away to places they don't know. Told their way of life's a God-forsaken choice. Holding hands to bear the slander, taking all till they surrendered light. Wander towards joy now, how it keeps me at bay. Whenever I'm alone, I remember your voice told to wander towards joy now, how it keeps me away. voice told to wander towards joy, know how it keeps me away. Whenever I'm alone, I remember your voice told to wander towards joy, know how it keeps me at bay.
Our reading today is called A House Called Tomorrow by Alberto Rios. You are not 15 or 12 or 17. You are 100 wild centuries and 15, bringing with you in every breath and in every step everyone who has come before you. All the yous that you have been, the mothers of your mother, the fathers of your father. If someone in your family tree was troubled, 100 were not. The bad do not win, not finally, no matter how loud they are. We simply would not be here if that were so. You are made fundamentally from the good. With this knowledge, you never march alone. You are the breaking news of the century. You are the good who has come forward through it all, even if so many days feel otherwise. But think, when you as a child learn to speak, it's not that you didn't know words, it's that from the centuries you knew so many. And it's hard to choose the words that will be your own. From those centuries, we human beings bring with us the simple solutions and songs, the river bridges and star charts and song harmonies, all in service to a simple idea that we can make a house called tomorrow. What we bring finally into the new day, every day, is ourselves. And that's all we need to start. That's everything we require to keep going. Look back only for as long as you must. Then go forward into the history you will make. Be good, then better. Write books. Cure disease. Make us proud. Make yourself proud. And those who came before you? When you hear thunder, hear it as their applause. We center ourselves. We breathe together. And breathing together, we sense one another's loving presence. Breathing in, breathing out, we follow our breath to a deeper place inside, a place of greater wisdom, a place where a spark of the divine resides within each of us. And breathing together, we enter into a time of sacred silence together, all the while remembering that we also hold sacred in this congregation human sounds, including those of small children. Breathing in, breathing out. We enter into that time of sacred silence together. I invite you now to light candles if you are so moved, candles representing sorrow, joy, hope, remembrance, resilience, whatever is on your heart at this time. As we light candles, I invite you to keep in your mind and heart members of our community who are ill or in sorrow, as well as those who are celebrating joys. Please especially hold in your hearts Joyce and Dan Wilson as Joyce faces health struggles and receives palliative care. Now let us enter into a time of candle lighting and meditation, holding the meditative silence when our music comes to a close.
Don't you feel so ridiculous like this? A dazzling ray surrounds you, but do you know what they say about you? What all did you lose to feel alive? How's the world look around you? Does it feel like it walks about you? Don't you feel it's better to be in disguise? Your shining hair, I'll stop and stare and cut away at your luscious light. But you keep on marching forth with greatest pride. I wasn't petrified, no. I wasn't petrified. I was afraid to learn to love you. I was afraid to learn to love you. You look so strong with your radiant colors. I was ashamed to know and love you. I was ashamed to know. They look so wrong when they tore you open. I didn't say enough and hold you. I didn't say couldn't feel the words and grace you open wide. I wasn't petrified. I was just lost in lies. So I'll live to carry on and love the ones who always need it.
Now we light one last candle for all those for whom there is no one to light a candle.
Last year, during the Festival of Homiletics, a week-long celebration of preaching and presentation by progressive, liberatory Christian preachers and scholars, I was struck by one particular story. So we are getting biblical this morning. One of the preachers mentioned Lot's wife and shared that she is the most referenced woman from the scriptures in poetry, I think it was. Lot's wife has been sitting with me for months, patiently waiting for her turn to teach us. Of course, it is Lot's wife who is unnamed in the scriptures, but who in the Midrash, the wisdom of rabbis that supplements the Torah, has named as Edith. She is the one who breaks God's instruction not to look back as she is fleeing from her home, which is being spectacularly destroyed, fleeing with her husband and their children who would leave, and for this, she instantly becomes a pillar of salt. Now, that story begins with God expressing that there has been such an outcry from people that they cannot ignore, that the twin cities of Sodom and Gomorrah had fallen into sinfulness, with the gravest sin perhaps being breaking the commandment to welcome the stranger, to love our neighbors, to be hospitable. To assess the situation there, God sends two emissaries to the city, two of the same who had just visited Abraham and Sarah, who despite their ages are promised their own child. Abraham just informed that he would be the father of nations despite being ancient, is told by God that Sodom is sinful, so they are preparing to make their way to Sodom, where one of Abraham's nephews, Lot, lives. Abraham pleads with God, "What if there are 50 good people? What if there are only 45? Maybe there are only 40. What if there are only 30 good people in the city? What if there are only 20? What if there are only 10? What if there are only 10 good people?" And God says he will not destroy the city if 10 are good. They arrive, and Lot, who has been at the gate, welcomes them into his home. Initially, the angels decline, but Lot urges them to stay with him. They eat well, and as night falls, the home is surrounded by the men of the town, demanding that the two be sent out. Lot begs them to behave and offers his daughters instead. And the crowd gets angrier. They only stop banging at the door when the angels strike them blind and they can no longer find it. This story is often misconstrued as one condemning homosexuality, but it is not about that at all. It is about the inhospitality of the residents, who have wealth and food in abundance, and somehow this has made them cruel instead of generous. It has become the practice of the men of the city to violently assault their visitors, which is why people cried out to God for help. And so God decides that the city must be destroyed. Lot and his family are given little time to collect their things and make their way out before God unleashes their destruction. Sulfur and fire, which leads to explosions and more. God warns them not to look back, or there will be consequences. But Lot's wife cannot help herself, it seems. So this raises a few questions. I've been spending some time with Krista Tippett and her philosophy of asking good questions. And so we begin with, what reason other then what other reason could there be that she would look back, knowing that it would be her end? It is natural for us to look back as we leave. We remember in those moments what was, has been, the promises we once felt held by. We think about the community that we had or dreamed of having, our roots, the places we loved, and for Lot's wife, that perhaps her children also loved. It is deeply human to recognize that places become homes, that our relationships with places and people are what shape and make our lives. Maybe she was looking back to see if her daughters, who had chosen to stay with their husbands, had changed their minds. How do you not look back and remember your hopes, the people who loved you into yourself, the memory of firsts and lasts and everything in between? As I left Pennsylvania to take my position in Tarpon Springs, I looked back as we drove across the Susquehanna River for the last time, wanting to have my last memory of the place not be one of pain, but of beauty. Perhaps Lot's wife was looking back to help her accept that the city was worthy of such destruction. Given how natural of an instinct turning back would be, it seems cruel to believe that God would want to punish anyone already facing such a terrible situation. So this is the second question. Why would God make such an instruction? In general, the God of the Hebrew Bible isn't the warmer and fuzzier God we get to know once Jesus enters the picture. But God is also not unreasonable or punishing for the sake of being punishing. So what would inspire them to make this instruction? Given the context of the rest of the scriptures, my interpretation is because sometimes we humans have a tendency to hold on too tightly to the past, even at the expense of our present and future. We continue to act in the ways we have acted, even when doing so keeps us locked in cycles of creating harm to ourselves. God's attempt at going scorched earth in these cities of licentiousness is to try to create a blank slate, to give the people a chance to begin again, to build something new, and one would expect, or at least hope, better. In order to do that, not only does Lot's family, the ones who are to survive, that they need to be far away, they need to be moving in the direction of forward with their hearts and minds, as well as with their bodies. Turning back slows us down and risks us getting stuck, whether physically or emotionally, as if looking back might cause us to freeze. As if turning Lot's wife into a pillar of salt was just an affirmation of her own unwillingness or unpreparedness to make space for the future or even the present. The third question is, why salt? Why does she turn into a pillar of salt? The Midrash says that Lot's wife went to other homes in Sodom, asking for salt so that she could share that she had guests for the evening. This is not part of the scriptures, though, and the text itself does not offer any insight into the question. What we do know is that salt is a component of tears. Being turned into a pillar of salt may be a way to convey tears of loss. Salt is also highly soluble in water. That is, when wet, salt will melt away. And land that is saturated with salt cannot grow anything. Salt is a cleanser, a purifying agent, a sanctifier. Perhaps being made a pillar of salt, which will not last as a monument to the past for long, and will become a stain upon the earth as a patch where nothing will grow, is what God is trying to warn against, that if there can be no good or healthy growth, there will be no growth at all. Without a future, the past will also be lost because there is no one left to carry it. Or, to quote from Paul Raiser in a 2010 UU World article, nearly a century ago, the Reverend Louis B. Fisher, the dean of the Universalist Seminary at St. Lawrence University, described, "Universalists are often asked to tell where they stand. The only true answer is that we do not stand at all. We move." Raiser continues, "Yet there are times when the opposite is true, when the realities are so daunting that we freeze up, playing out Dean Fisher's aphorism in reverse. We do not move, we stand. And more, when we decide to go it alone, to look backward more than we are willing to move forward, we lose ourselves. We wander into a wilderness of our own making and without companions, surrounded by what seeks to separate us from one another. Lot's wife is a warning to us that where we travel, we must go together if we are to have any hope." To reference another scriptural story, the one about Moses leading the people from Egypt, too often we focus on the 40 years wandering the desert. And with good reason, we understand that hardship. But in doing so, we overlook the effort that it takes to leave Egypt at all. Some people protest, "The journey will be hard," and, "Is being a slave really so bad when you know how the system works?" They clung to their horrendous conditions because they were familiar. The past can feel like a warm comforter on a cold day. Because sometimes we humans have a tendency to hold on too tightly to the past, even at the expense of our present and future. We continue to act in ways that we have acted, even when doing so keeps us locked in cycles of creating harm to ourselves. Communities, including congregations that are not moving or resting actively, are dying. Resting from the lens of doing appropriate care, of catching our breath, of meditating to bring us calm, or to help us dream, of taking the time to ask the hard questions. These are all active resting. Refusing to engage in these practices, like refusing to do the work to move forward, is an indication of dis-ease, of unwellness. We become like Lot's wife, frozen in time. The thing is that generosity is not just about money, or your time, talent, and treasure, as we so often say. It's about all of that and more, about the ways that we are open to curiosity, hospitality, care. The ways we think about not just this moment, but about this moment in the context of what has been and what will yet be possible based on what we do today. Generosity is temporal this way. It extends from before all the way to beyond. It's also a conversation that we have, both with the past and the future, to give direction to the present. It's a conversation we have with all that is possible now. Perhaps we are like children who created Roxaboxen, whose imaginations inspire them to create homes and neighborhoods out of boxes, stones, glass, cactus, and other odds and ends. The present offers different possibilities to us, just as the future does, if we let it. Generosity is about reaching beyond ourselves into the future, doing just a little bit more than is necessary to make other things possible. We need to be generous in holding space for dreaming, for others' dreams that we alone cannot imagine, but that will save us nonetheless. We need to look forward at least as much as we are looking back. Are we reaching forward for the generosity the future is trying to extend to us? How do we hold space in this moment to honor the past, to name what it has given us, and to allow the future to also be possible? A healthy past wants us to let go and grow forward. When Lot's wife looked back, she was holding herself back from being able to hold space for other possibilities in that moment. When I left Pennsylvania, I was already making space in my heart and mind for Florida for a couple of months. My looking back was a last goodbye, an act of closure. Our minds sometimes imagine us living in the future, or our hearts and minds may try to convince us that we live in the past. We know how that turned out, though. We can only ever live in this moment, in the present. Our own imaginations as we age may become less inspired, less curious, less interesting. Imagination is something that we have to practice, and congregations have to practice this together. And every time someone comes or goes, we have to rework the possibilities we have been imagining to make space for everyone, to practice a generosity of spirit. And we can, if we choose to do so. Choose to make a little more space. Choose to be a little bit more flexible. Choose to dream a little bigger. Choose to lean in a little more. May we choose to do the next right thing, the next caring thing, the next thing worth doing for the tomorrow we hope to build.
Please say with me our words for extinguishing the chalice. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we hold in our hearts until we are together again.
For the last 4 years, I have been closing out my services to the congregation I have been serving with these same words that come from Jean Harrison Nuyar, who has written in The Gift of Faith. In the lore of ancient China, there is a story of a philosopher who was asked, "Where is the road called hope?" He replied, "It does not exist, but as people move upon it, it comes into being." I invite you to continue moving forward on this path, this journey called hope, together in Unitarian Universalism with me.
This is a production of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, go to our website at austinuu.org.